You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialized fiction written and read by Tansy Rayner Roberts. Now, it's not a fiction episode this week. We've just had our enormous, epic serial, Let Sleeping Princes Lie, rolled to a close last week. You can go and listen to all 21 episodes of it now. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you can download the ebook. Everybody else, you'll be able to pre-order the ebook from whichever ebook platform you like later this month. Okay, so to take a little break from the fiction, I decided to do another Ask Me Anything episode. And I have some great questions. Some of the questions I've been sent are more in the way of, let's just say, shipping forecast, which I highly encourage. I love to hear which of my characters you are shipping with each other. And sometimes I will comment on whether or not that's something that's going to be true in the future or, you know, whatever. Like, I'm just the canon. You guys just, you can hold your heart whoever you want. Okay. Also, bear in mind, I don't always know which of my fictional characters are going to end up with each other. That's a level of planning that my characters and I don't always agree on. So, yeah, keep that one in mind. Now, next week, I'm going to be studying some more fiction. I'm actually not quite sure what's going to go next week, depending on what happens with the Creature Court Kickstarter, which is currently open for pledges. I may be doing something Creature Court-y next week, or I may be doing my originally scheduled fiction serial that I was planning to do next, which is a reprint of the short story Cookie Cutter Superhero. If I do end up doing a couple of Creature Court weeks, then you'll get Cookie Cutter Superhero after that. I'm not going to deprive you of my beautiful superheroes. So that's what the next few weeks are going to look like. But I don't know. You know, everything's up in the air. My brain is full of Kickstarter. If you have not yet checked out my Creature Court Kickstarter, go and have a look. My next, let's not say next. Let's face it, I'll probably do another one here before that one comes. I don't even know what I'm doing. There is a Creature Court novella that I am writing that will be coming out mid-year. And the way to get it is to pre-order it through the Kickstarter. If you loved the old, they're not that old, it was 2010, my epic fantasy series, Creature Court. This is a way to pre-order ebooks or hardbacks. There are lots of cool rewards. There are mice. Come on by the Kickstarter. Have a look at it. And hopefully it'll fund not only these books and the amazing art and everything, but also a paperback run next year. But of course, that'll only happen if this Kickstarter funds. That's enough of my advertising. Let's go to questions. Okay, the first one is from HM Pinky. She asks, I don't know. They ask, how do you manage to create such engaging stories? I'm so taken in by them. You're an amazing writer. That is a very nice question. It's probably an impossible question to answer. I create stories to entertain myself for the most part, and I know everybody says that, but I'm actually a really picky reader. I have to be attached to characters or I'm not interested in the story. If I am interested in characters, I am there for the long haul. I can't tell you how many times I got addicted to things like Days of Our Lives because I got hooked on the characters and I needed to know what happened next. So that pretty much happens to me as a writer as well, which is why this whole format I've been doing for Sheep Might Fly is really fun, getting to do short stories and novellas that build up characters and then return to those same characters again and again. It's the benefit of writing longer work without the pressure of writing a novel, which, a novel just takes over your life and eats the contents of your brain out. And not that I'm, against novels. Novels are great, but I'm so in love with the novella, and I'm so in love with the novella series right now because, it lets me to have that hit of returning to characters again and again and finding out what happened to them next. So I'm a very character-led reader and a character-led writer. But I've been entertaining myself with stories since I was a kid. I used to have, in retrospect, quite appalling insomnia, which I only realized when my eldest child developed really bad insomnia over the last few years. And I was like, well, yeah, isn't that normal at this age? I used to lie awake for 2 hours before I went to sleep every night. And then people look at you like you're nuts. You go, oh, is that not normal? I would lie awake for hours. And because I was awake, I like to think it's because I was awake and not the other way around, I would tell myself stories. Mostly fanfic, really, but like imaginary fanfic in my head, which I still do to this day because that's how I relax my brain. I almost never write it down. But when I was a kid, I was telling myself like Famous Five stories and things like that to keep myself entertained until my brain would finally fall to sleep. In retrospect, it's possible that I was contributing to my own insomnia, but hey, I developed a skill. All right. Thank you for that lovely question, Pinky. Okay, I have a couple of questions, some questions from Melina Dams. The first one is, how has your writing routine changed as your kids grow older? It's one of those things, there's no set point because you always have to be adaptive. I was once in the dim days of my university life when I was cheating on my university degree with all the novels I was writing. I was the sort of writer who really needed a day to myself to properly dig into my writing. You know, I needed to have no one in the house and just have a day which was devoted to writing, and then I could get stuff done. And I look back on that younger self and I laugh and I laugh. And I kind of wish that I'd got myself together a bit earlier with more in the way of discipline to write wherever and whenever. And I could have got a lot more books, I think, done under my belt before I had children. I love my children. Yeah, writing with kids is hard. It also teaches you to not be precious. I didn't get back to writing fiction with my first child until probably about a year or two into the process, largely because I had to finish my PhD thesis first. And then when I did, it was really hard. I had to pretty much retrain my brain to write 100 words at a time. It was brutal. But then when I did get back into it, I did learn to write in bits and pieces. I must have done okay at it because I finished Power and Majesty, which is the first book of the Creature Court trilogy that I keep talking about for my Kickstarter. I finished that book in late 2007, because 2008 was the year in which the whole process was being sold. Well, my kid was born in early 2005, and I know there was a big chunk before I got back to writing, so I must have been pretty good at it when I did get back to it. Actually, there was about a year in between there where I dealt with finishing my PhD thesis by obsessively getting involved in a Harry Potter role play community, which taught me to write really fast, to show people stuff that I'd literally just written. And that taught me to get over a lot of preciousness. And that actually helped me write my book faster and better and more emotionally resonant, I think, which was my excuse for spending so many hours when I was supposed to be looking after my toddler at a laptop doing Harry Potter role playing. It actually is what kicked my brain into writing gear, amazingly. That also taught me that I can write anywhere. If you're really, really invested in your role playing enough to write anywhere, you can also do that with your novel. It was harder with the second child, but my second child came along when I was already in the midst of this trilogy deal with HarperCollins. I had to write it. I had deadlines. So Jemima, my youngest, I wrote around having a baby from a few weeks onwards. Jemima was born in August and I did NaNoWriMo that year. It's actually, I personally found easier to write with a baby the first 6 months of their life than the second 6 months of their life. So I got quite a bit done then. And then within 6 months, I had Jemima in at least 1 or 2 days of daycare which I'd taken a lot longer with my older child. Because I had to have that time, not the whole day necessarily to myself in the way that I used to, you know, oh, I need a whole day to myself in order to write. I just needed the time. I needed the space. It's really hard when there's a kid around, when there's two kids around. And it's still like, it's not any easier now. Yes, I can explain to them now why mummy is disappearing into the library, but that doesn't mean they won't sneak in and try and give me hugs, which is the one thing against which I have no defense. And so this Saturday, I was literally here in the library, which is where I am right now. And I thought, I just need a couple of hours to get some writing done and really kind of dig into what I'm doing. And the rest of the family were asleep, and my 8-year-old had weirdly got bored of watching television, which is not something that happens very often in our house, and came in to sit on my armchair and hug me and entertain me, mummy. And I'm like, really? Is there nothing on Netflix for 2 hours that could, like, absorb you? Feeling really guilty about this, but, you know, sometimes you've got to do what you've got to do. And she's like, but hugs, mummy. And I'm like, but I have this thing I have to write. He's like, but hugs, mummy. So, in other words, I basically fired up my laptop, found Netflix on my laptop, went through every page of Netflix, trying to find something to make her eyes light up. It's possible I should feel guilty about this, but I don't. It was Saturday morning. Why was she even awake? Anyway, long story short, that's how I introduced my 8-year-old to Bugs Bunny, and I have no regrets. I do write when they're at school, when I can. If they're not at school, I work around it. But they are pretty respectful of my time. They get a lot of my time, and I do remind them, you know, I'm here when they get home from school. I take them to their activities. They get a lot of mum time because I work from home. But the other side of that is I work from home, and that means often I'm working where they can see me working. I'm not always available to play stuff, even if I'm home. I think it's a perfectly reasonable payoff. They usually agree. Writing routine. I don't have a writing routine. I'm terrible. Take my child to school. My husband takes the other child to school because they're in different schools now. That's really difficult. I get home just after 9, got distracted with my Kickstarter for half an hour, spent a bit of time weaning myself off the Kickstarter by reading fanfic, went off that to do something else, pinned myself down to do some proper writing, fell into it for 3 hours, got a lot written. That was a really productive day, but, you know, I had to sneak up on myself to make that a productive day. And actually, the thing I was supposed to do first was record this podcast, which I'm now doing in the window before I have to go pick the kids up from school. So sometimes I only get a really good writing day if I procrastinate and cheat on all the other things. It's kind of terrible, but it works for me. I have to sneak up on myself to be productive. And deadlines are helpful. That deadline of the kids coming home from school is a pretty brutal one because technically I can close the door on them most days and they'll just do their own thing after school. But it feels like the workday is over when they come home. Anyway, Melina also asks, which is better for writing, cake or tea? Both are excellent for writing. I do like to have a cup of tea. My trouble with tea is I like it best when somebody else makes it for me. And if somebody is home to make me tea, that probably means other distractions from writing. Obviously, as I explained to my teenager recently, I can make tea myself. I do know how. It just tastes better when other people make it for me. To which my teenager replied, I can teach you to make it the way I make it, Mum. And I'm like, that's not the point. Also, I taught you to make tea. Also, I'm thirsty. Can you make me a cup of tea? Cake is very similar. I quite like it when other people make cake. Cake is very good to write with. I do not currently have cake or tea. and did not have any during any of my writing time. I came away ravenous because I wrote through lunchtime. Now I want both cake and tea. So that's something else to add to my to-do list for the day. Melina also asks, any chance of you ever returning to the Musketeer Space universe? Basically, I need more Aramis. Mel, we all need more Aramis in our life. And I say this as someone who never really liked any of the other Aramises all that much. But I love my Aramis deeply. I do want to write more in the Musketeer Space universe, both with those Musketeer characters in particular, because I love them so much. I refuse to come back and only write a 20 years later sequel because I think that would be just devastating, frankly. I always got unhappy about Musketeer adaptations that push this idea that the Musketeers are on the brink of retirement, that almost that the Three Musketeers story is like the end of the golden era, because D'Artagnan's just got there. We need many, many, many years of them all hanging out together. Having said that, there is some great material to work with in the 20 years later and other sequels. I have seeded potential big next generational sequels in, you know, those little babies that were seeded into the story. But I wouldn't want, I think, to leap to a 20 years later sequel. I'm quite keen on writing stories on my sweeties while they're still in this current phase of their life. I also really like the universe that I built. You know, I kind of created the solar system for the Musketeer Space stories. I was originally going to set it, just make it futuristic, but that had the slight problem of, is this a universe in which the Three Musketeers was a novel in this, in, you know, was, is a novel, and then in the future, you know, it's kind of hard. It's like, how meta can you get? Putting it in a fictional universe that has never heard of the novel The Three Musketeers by Dumas was easier. There was also the religious aspect, because there's a lot of religious elements in the original story that I felt really uncomfortable with imposing on an actual historical religion, particularly in a futuristic. I didn't feel like I was in a position to be writing about what Catholicism is going to look like in 400 years' time. That seemed supremely dodgy to me. And there was no way I was going to, like, you know, swap in something else like Islam. I mean, can you imagine? No, especially because the religious aspect of the original book, you know, the religious figures are the antagonists, whether you're talking about the cardinal, who's super dodgy, or even just that whole thing of trying to stop Aramis disappearing into the priesthood. So I decided fictional religion was a much better idea. So I created this new universe, the solar system. And there are so many elements of it that I love, like these iconic planets, and each of them have, you know, like truth and peace and honour. They have these really evocative names, and I had these sort of clear ideas about what they were like, but I didn't get to visit very many in the book because we were too busy having space adventures. So I'd quite like to actually use that solar system as the backdrop for other science fictional stories, adventures, which only have very tangential connections to my sweeties. I have at least one planned, which is a kind of gothic spaceship story that I think belongs in that universe, and I'm quite excited about that. The working title is Someone's Trying to Kill Me, and I think it's my spaceship. But I want to write more Aramis and Dana and Athos and Porthos, and yeah, I love those guys. I'm totally going back. Okay, more questions. Books and Sundry gave me this wonderful long list. So these are not really questions, but a quest for reassurance that my ships will come true. Oh, sweetie. So let's start. I thought Kai and Dennis were all sorted, but you've hinted at troubles ahead with only one story to go. These two are the most important. They must get their HEA. That's happy ever after. For those of you who aren't into the romance, you know, genre tropes. Look, I don't want to spoil things for things I haven't written yet. But Kai and Dennis are totally endgame. Like, that's not even in question. That's kind of the point of these stories. Castle Charming. I'm not sure how hard it's going to be to get to that endgame. And I'm a little bit worried that I have an awful lot to get done in that crucial fourth installment of Castle Charming. I'm trying to resist the urge to, like, matchmake absolutely everybody because part of me is just, like, everybody. But it's like, you know what? They're all, like, somewhere between 17 and 20 years old. They do not all need to figure out their happy ever afters at this age. And some of them, you know, a romantic partner is not necessarily the thing they need most out of character growth. But Kai and Dennis are totally endgame. Like, I would break my own heart if I stuffed that up too badly. I'm pretty sure I'm not gonna. No promises. But I think that one's fairly secure. Okay, Books and Sundry continues with alarming insight into how my brain works. Now, I have no idea what your plans are for Jack and Ziggy, but I seriously hope they're going to be together. I'd actually really be happy to see them in an OT3, but I'm open to who that third would be. Okay, Jack and Ziggy. I thought I was being subtle about that one. I was pretty sure I hadn't put anything overt in. So I'm delighted that you picked up on that. I don't know where I'm going with it or how far, but I am actually working on one of the Patreon short stories for this year, which is going to answer the question in more depth for everyone, including me. The story is only part written. I need to get back to it. So far it's called Charm or Dare, and it's about an elaborate drinking and kissing game that the princes invented, that causes all kinds of hype. It's the most ridiculously indulgent story. But I'm pretty sure we're going to get at least a Jack and Ziggy snog out of it. Otherwise, what's the point of anything? But I don't know. I've got to go back and write that. So hopefully they'll be out in the next few months. Books and Sundry continues, putting cats among pigeons. I'm feeling fairly confident and happy about Hebe and Ferd. We're into the fake geek girl universe now. And don't go getting ideas. Those two deserve calm happiness while all the rest are crazy around them. Oh, sweetie. Yeah, no, look. Again, characters are somewhere between 18 and 20. Nobody is like, nobody is endgame. I'm not committing anybody to, like, that. I think you're right for at least another story or two. I do have some interesting twists ahead in mind for Hebe and Ferd. I don't know what's going to happen at the other end of it. I will be interested to find out, but I am quite attached to them. And of course they are, by no means obliged to be together because of this, but they're kind of the hub around which their friends' crazy social life revolves. So the idea of them not being together would be kind of fascinating to see, you know, how everybody would cope with that kind of, you know, that really traumatic breakup when the friends that you thought were going to be together forever. Yeah. I don't know if I'm doing that, just putting that out there, but there are going to be questions. There are going to be challenges. They're not just going to be the couple in the background you don't have to worry about. In fact, the next Fake Geek Girl story that I'm writing later this year, working title is Halloween is Not a Verb. And that's going to have Ferd meeting the family, which could be interesting. I don't know. I haven't written it yet. Books and Sundry continues. Sage and Jules, I've mentioned before. I remain hopeful, but I'm prepared for desolation at the same time. Yeah. Return to the endgame point. Sage and Jules are both hot messes. Neither of them is in a place to be endgame for anybody. Having said that, I don't think they're done, and I don't think I'm done with them, but I have no idea what's in store for either of them. Some characters that I write are quite predictable in their directions and their interests. These two, I don't know, but they're so sort of similar and opposite. They're really fun to write. I think they'll be coming back to each other possibly far too often than is healthy. And again, interesting challenges ahead. Like there were quite a few revelations about these two in particular that came out for me when I was writing the bromances, which I didn't know about when I started writing it. So yeah, I look forward to playing with them again and seeing what happens. This is what keeps me writing, you know? I gotta find out what happens to these guys. Okay, still going on Books and Sundry's epic shipping forecast. As for Sweet Juniper, I'm actually hoping she finds someone worthy of her. I don't dislike Holly, but gosh, I'd be happy for her to find someone utterly devoted to making Juniper happy. I want that too. You know, I do. I, again, don't know where they're going. I don't think Holly is ready for Juniper yet, frankly. I think she's barely at a stage where she could actually handle the kind of settled, happy relationship that, frankly, they both deserve, but Juniper especially. Like, I don't know if by the time Holly is actually at a stage where she's, like, grown up enough to be in a relationship with Juniper, I don't know if they'll be in the same place. So I guess we'll find out. Let's hope none of us get our hearts broken over that one. Books and Sundry continues, I've decided that Viola and Deck are the most settled. You wouldn't think it would work, but they're going to be the most stable of all, I hope. Sorry, ship them from the first instance, and I just can't have them any other way. My poor romantic heart is prepared for its pummeling. Please don't be too mean. I never mean to be mean. Yeah, Viola and Deck, I don't know where they came from. Maybe they will be the new Hebe and Ferd. I don't know. They are really sweet. And they seem to be weirdly functional. But, you know, they're all at university. Anything could happen. I'm looking forward to writing these guys again. I'm cutting quite, I'm still a few, another month or two out from being able to work on this story. So, it's really getting me in the right brain space. I'll have to come back and listen to this podcast when I start work on the next one. Ju, who raised questions in the same Slack channel, adds to this, I'm similarly invested in all these questions, but I will say that I'd be up for Juniper and Holly, especially if Holly took a massive growth curve with a loving but relentless Juniper. And yeah, that's absolutely the key point. Holly needs to grow up a bit more. The fact that, you know, she's almost got this indulgent circle of terrible relationships, which are safe in a way because she doesn't really have to connect. So yeah, I don't know. I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with Holly and Juniper, but you know, I kind of ship them, but that means nothing. I have sunk many of my own ships, just to let you know. There's still a few I haven't quite forgiven myself for with Creature Court. Especially now I'm thinking of the possibility of writing sequels at some point. I'm like, am I gonna actually with that relationship, or is it gone forever? I don't know. I'm my own worst enemy as both reader and writer. Okay, last one, which is good because I've been just talking to myself for ages and I do have to pick the kids up soon. Mac the Cat asks, I am actually curious about your writer background. When did you start writing? Did you ever take classes? That sort of thing. Okay. I started writing when I was very young. As I said, I talked earlier about the making the stories up in my head. I did an awful lot of writing first pages of novels because I was reading novels really young. My mother taught me to read when I was about 2.5 because we lived in the bush and I was bored. So I had this really intensive reading program. I was reading like Enid Blyton novels and the like at 3 and 4. So I thought in novels from a very early age. It's taken me a lot longer to wrap my head around actually short stories because I always thought in novels. So at the age of 8, I was writing, you know, page 1 of a novel and then designing the book covers for my various I always thought in really long series. I think perhaps because I read, you know, Famous Five and Anne of Green Gables and Laura Ingalls Wilder and all those things. Those are all series. And then later on I discovered fantasy, and so all my series ended up having like dragons and stuff added. But I always thought in novels. I started properly writing an actual novel-length work that I took seriously when I was 14. My friends all went home from, like, birthday sleepover, and there was a big stack of mattresses left over afterwards, and I lay down on that big stack of mattresses, and I started plotting, writing this epic fantasy series. And I wrote and worked on that throughout high school. Like, I was always writing a book. By the time I got to college, which is grade 11 and 12, I kind of abandoned my big fantasy epic, but I wrote, like, three novel manuscripts between grade 11 and 12, two of which were different versions of the crime, the same crime book that eventually became A Trifle Dead, written by Livia Day. There was also an assassin comedy novel that I've never got back to, and I have no idea where it is, but I actually think it was kind of great, and I might, like, it was space opera, and there was this assassin character, and it was very cartoony, but I did love it dearly, so I wonder if there's any copies of any of that. But yeah, so I was writing really, really full on. And then first year of uni, literally the first day, I started writing the book that became Splashdance Silver. So I was writing, thinking in novels, huge amounts through my teens. I didn't really take classes. I struggled to find any kind of writing mentorship or teachers that were relevant to me, because I was interested in fantasy and science fiction. I remember at grade 8, we had a negotiated study where we got to pick a theme and we were supposed to work on a project, any project that was something we loved. And so I was like, well, I'm writing this 12 book fantasy series. So how about if I put together, you know, a first chapter and do all this sort of stuff around it. And my English teacher couldn't even talk to me about genre because the words that she was using didn't connect to the way that what I knew about genre. That was, you know, she was trying, but it was difficult. When I was at college, I wasn't going to do creative writing because you can only count so many subjects from each category or each, like, department towards your TE score, which is the university score. So there's no point, literally no point, in doing more than two subjects from any one department. And I'm like, well, I already know that I want to do English and I'm going to do English Lit, so I'll just do, like, a short course in creative writing. That's fine. And I was there for 5 minutes and the teacher was like, yeah, we're putting you in the full writing course. And I'm like, fine. So I did this extra full writing course. But again, I really struggled with it because the teacher was really interested in writing, but not interested in the kind of writing that I did. So we were doing short stories and stuff, and I was doing, you know, weird, kooky, Douglas Adams-style surrealist stuff. And, like, I wasn't even writing about swords and dragons, you know? I was trying to bring it down to their level. But, yeah, it was that communication about, you know, it was like they wanted me to write something normal, and I didn't even know what normal was because that wasn't something that I read. I didn't even try at university. At that stage, I'd pretty much decided that that wasn't something that organized school system, that they weren't going to be able to help me with genre. So my choices going into university, I knew I was going to write. I knew that was my future direction, whatever I ended up doing for a job. wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, I knew I wanted to write, so I figured, okay, I'll just take subjects of things that interest me so I'll have stuff to write about, which I think was a pretty good attitude. I went in expecting to do an awful lot of medieval history, but I found those subjects not as interesting as some of the stuff that I found in English and classics. So that was what I ended up majoring in. So I did a lot of Latin and literature and ancient history. And in English, I did all sorts of stuff. I loved the Shakespeare courses. I did a lot of that sort of stuff, thinking about classic books. I did end up taking one. I got to take one popular fictions course, which did include one science fiction and one fantasy novel. I was so disappointed when I got to the week where we had the fantasy novel tutorial. It was a Sarah Douglas novel. Nobody in the tutorial had read it except me because it was, you know, a book the size of a small boat. But we did William Gibson's New Romance, and we did crime and romance and stuff. It was a good course. I was more excited in it a few years back when they started teaching the course at our university again, and they put Power and Majesty on the syllabus. That was exciting. I since got to know the lecturer who did that. That was really awesome. No, I did one creative writing course at college, at university, pretty much as a blow-off course because I felt like a relaxing term, and I was also going to be translating the Aeneid from Latin. So I'm like, you know what, I'll just do creative writing. That'll be easy. And of course it wasn't easy because I had a really enthusiastic, supportive teacher who really appreciated the stuff that I was writing. But again, there was that disconnect because the professor didn't really get genre. She was probably one of the most supportive of the genre thing in theory. But yeah, so I never had that. And round about the time I was doing all this, like I sold my first novel finishing third year university was when I sold my first novel. So at that point on, when you're a published writer, there is this assumption that you know how to do it. So actually, most of the development opportunities aren't really there for you after that point. What happened to me was, though, and it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, I got scooped up at some point in the next couple of years. I really struggled to enter science fiction fandom community in Australia. There was quite a lot of bumps in the road trying to connect to the community until, you know, I became part of the ASIM collective and actually, you know, had a bunch of supportive friends and a posse, and that was really fun, and I met my people. But it took a few years. But along the way, I got scooped up by this group of writers who were in a sort of similar stage to me. They happened to be all women. The original group, this is the Raw Collective, with people like Marianne DePierre and Rowena Corey Daniels. They started this group. They wanted something for a professional development because of that whole thing. If once you've had a novel or two published, and we were all kind of at that stage, we'd had like a couple of books published. Once you got to that stage, there isn't professional development stuff really offered for you. And so the idea was we'd provide our own. So we created the Raw Collective. The original group was all women, purely by happenstance. Those are the ones who ended up coming along and then later added some men to the group too. Every 18 months or so, we would do a manuscript exchange and we would go somewhere in the country, because we were all scattered around Australia. We would read each other's manuscripts for the month ahead of time, and then we would get together for like a 3 or 4 day weekend. And we would give intense manuscript feedback. And that, and the networking stuff that came out of that, and the friendships that came out of that, and the learning about craft and publishing that came out of that, was just so invaluable. And I was always just so grateful that they'd seen something in me, that they'd picked me. And Marianne and Rowena and many others kind of, yeah, they mentored me, and they, you know, got me invited to things. And it was just the occasional thing that made me feel like, because I was so young, for many of the like writers in the group, we were at a sort of similar stage career-wise, but they were all older than me. I was such a baby. I was still like barely in my early 20s. And I had no idea what I was doing, and I hadn't really been able to turn my opportunities into a career. Even after getting published, you know, I made a lot of pretty rookie mistakes, and yeah, a lot of stuff happened. And so having those people there to, like, they're still there. We don't do Raw anymore. I think all of our careers have gone in such different, and family lives and everything has just gone in such different directions. None of us are in the position really to all have a manuscript ready at the same time, which is pretty much what put a stop to it. But we did this for like nearly 10 years, and, you know, I still have those people. If I need professional advice, if I want to bounce something past some people, they're there for me. And yeah, that creating our own development, was a really important thing because it isn't always available from any kind of organised... I mean, universities are different now. There are so many universities in Australia now which offer really great specific academia for science fiction. Marianne, one of the people from Raw, she's currently doing her PhD in angry science fiction by women. It's amazing some of the stuff that's out there, but there just was hardly any of that when I was younger. And certainly there was nothing at UTAS. So yeah, creating your own development. And we were all like at fairly similar levels. I think finding your peers, I mean, it's great to have a mentor who's like really much further ahead in the game professionally. Like that is so valuable, but it's rare because when people are really quite far ahead in the publishing game, they're also really busy. And there's a limit to how much they can offer to, you know, up and coming type people because they're just trying to keep their heads above water. But finding that support group of people at a similar kind of level to you professionally, who are all going to grow and develop in interesting ways. I mean, we read, like Margot Lanigan was part of our group. And when we started, she had a, you know, she'd published a few books here and there, but only a couple under her own name, books of short stories, YA ones. We read the manuscript of Black Juice for our group. And we read Singing My Sister Down, her short story. And like, it was an amazing experience. We could offer very little in the way of like feedback to the manuscript. It was basically done. But like we looked at it and we were just like, this is amazing. And over the next couple of years, that book just changed her life and her career. Like that was what opened her up internationally. Like her reputation just soared because of this book. And to see that happen from the ground up and to just kind of get even a little bit of an insight or a little bit of a sort of behind the scenes stuff of seeing that happen to one of your friends is kind of amazing. Yeah, so not sure if this was quite the direction it was going in, but depending on who you can find, as far as writing classes and stuff, it's all about who the teacher is. It honestly is. If it's somebody you think you can learn from who can teach you stuff, then go for it. But otherwise, there's not a lot of benefit. I taught creative writing for most of my 20s, which is a weird other thing that I did. I did taught night classes. You know, I had publishing credits. Maybe once every two terms, I might get one person out of a class of 10 who'd come along not just because they were interested in writing, because these were night classes, so they were a mixture of people who were really interested in writing or people who like wanted to give it a try because they did, you know, something with dried flowers the previous term, you know. And there's all people who wanted to tell their family story. You had a lot of different reasons why people come to a writing class. Every couple of terms, there'd be like one person who came because I was the person teaching it and I had a fantasy novels published and they were interested in science fiction or fantasy and they wanted to learn that from me. And it was always exciting for me as a teacher to get that as well. I still teach. I teach kids now. And I love doing the holiday writing workshops with the kids because I would have killed for something like that when I was 14 to have an actual published science fiction fantasy writer teaching me stuff and reading my work and being able to ask questions and not have them look at me like I was a crazy person because I wanted to write something with dragons in. Okay, I have been rambling far too long. Thank you all for listening. This may be the longest episode yet of Sheep Might Fly. But we'll be back to our short fictional excerpts of something or other next week. Thank you for being here and for following my podcast and reading my stuff. I never cease to be grateful for that. Okay, thanks for listening to Sheep Might Fly. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Twitter at TansyRR or Sheep Might Fly. Find me on Facebook at TansyRR Books. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of cool rewards, early ebooks, and exclusive stories from a small monthly pledge. Speaking of pledges, go look at my Kickstarter. It's so pretty. See you next week.